Welcome to Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. We've all taken ibuprofen for a headache or antibiotics to treat an infection. We wash our hair with shampoo, we clean our floors and counters with any number of commercially available concoctions. Pharmaceuticals, personal care products, and cleaning agents have become routine and in some cases indispensable parts of our lives. But do they belong in our drinking water? A new study by researchers at Silent Spring Institute finds that the majority of public drinking water wells on Cape Cod contain at least one such contaminant of emerging concern, as they're collectively known. And a synthesis of Silent Spring Institute's extensive research in this area indicates our septic systems are almost certainly the source of the contaminants. So, is this a problem? Should we be worried about our health? And if so, what should we do about it? Joining me to help us make sense of the new findings is Dr. Laurel Shader. She's a research scientist at Silent Spring Institute and the lead author of both new reports. Laurel Shader, welcome to Living Lab.
Thanks for having me, Heather.
Now, these topics tend to generate a lot of questions and concerns. We encourage you to join our conversation by calling 866-999-4626. Our email, you can email us at livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. You can also find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or Twitter. So, Laurel Shader, contaminants of emerging concern, this is a kind of a vague collective term. What are these chemicals, and can you give us some examples that we might actually recognize?
Sure. So, contaminants of emerging concern or emerging contaminants are chemicals that are not currently regulated in drinking water, but are of concern because of potential human or ecological health effects. There isn't really a set list for exactly what is an emerging contaminant, but we tend to think about pharmaceuticals, hormones, flame retardants, fragrances, detergents, and other chemicals that are in consumer products. And wastewater is typically the way that these get out into the environment. In some cases, these may be emerging because they're, you know, brand new chemicals that have just gone into production. But for the most part, they are of emerging concern, because it's just been really in the last 10 to 20 years that we've had the ability to measure them at the parts per trillion levels that are typically found in the environment.
So it's really our knowledge or awareness of them that's emerging, not so much the chemicals or their presence in the environment.
That's true. And with more people and more products being used, we might expect that their levels in the environment would be increasing, but mostly it's our awareness because of new analytical techniques.
So we don't really have a good historical estimate of what these were, because you're saying that the technologies to trace them are really quite new.
Yeah, that's true. There was a large study in 2002 by the U.S. Geological Survey that showed that about 80% of the streams that they tested, they looked at 140 streams throughout the U.S., contained at least one emerging contaminant. And that was really one of the first studies that put this topic on the national radar screen.
So let's talk a little bit about the new study that was just published last Thursday in the journal Science of the Total Environment. You were the lead author on this study, and you tested water from 20 public drinking water wells on Cape Cod and found at least one of these contaminants of emerging concern in 15 of those. Did that surprise you at all?
It didn't surprise us that much. There have been many studies throughout the U.S. showing the presence of these chemicals in surface waters. There haven't been as many studies of groundwater, but there are certainly some reasons to think that groundwater on Cape Cod might be likely to contain these chemicals. You know, about 85% of Cape Cod residents have a septic system, and most people, everyone on the Cape, relies on groundwater as a source of drinking water. We've also got this sand and gravel aquifer that allows the groundwater to move relatively quickly, so there's less opportunity for chemicals to break down or to stick to the soils as it moves along.
Were there chemicals that were particularly common in these drinking water wells?
So the two chemicals that we found most frequently were sulfamethoxazole, that's an antibiotic used to treat urinary tract infections and pneumonia. And we also found PFOS, this is a perfluorinated chemical, and it's used in nonstick and stain-resistant products, as well as having some commercial uses.
So that last one, I mean, we're not just talking about pharmaceuticals or chemicals that we're ingesting. We're talking about chemicals that might just be in use or be occurring elsewhere in our households.
That's right. There can be chemicals associated with our food packaging, with our textiles, our fabrics, our carpets that can also make their way into water.
I mean, how does that happen? I mean, you can very easily imagine how, you know, a medicine that you've taken obviously makes its way into our wastewater. But how do some of these other chemicals actually end up in the water?
Yeah, there hasn't actually been a lot of work to document the exact pathways. Some of the chemicals are found in food packaging and in cookware. Others are in nonstick and stain-resistant textiles and surfaces. So you could imagine doing the laundry that has some of those kinds of fabrics in them could be a source. In some cases, it's possible that runoff or other sources of contamination are possible as well.
So what kind of levels are we talking about when you say that you've found these chemicals in drinking water?
For the most part, these chemicals were found at the parts per trillion or nanograms per liter level. So to put that into some context, typical drinking water standards for regulated contaminants, so some organic contaminants, are in the parts per billion level. So we're used to thinking of kind of higher concentrations. Those are about 1,000 times higher. In the case of pharmaceuticals, you know, if you're talking about how much you might be exposed to from taking a medication, you know, that's milligrams that you might be taking per day. So that's several orders of magnitude even higher than the levels that you might get through drinking water.
So we're getting maybe a millionth of what would be an actual effective dose of a medicine when we drink tap water on Cape Cod.
Right, that's right.
Is that a level that you feel we should be concerned about?
Well, I don't think that anyone would really prefer to drink water that has these chemicals in it. We don't know whether there are health effects at these trace levels, but there are certainly reasons to be concerned. In the case of pharmaceuticals, you know, we typically don't give medications to pregnant women or to young children. We know that there can be side effects that occur at levels below a therapeutic dose. So just looking at your kind of daily dosage is not necessarily the only benchmark to compare these drinking water levels to. And there's also concern that mixtures of chemicals can cause effects in combination that you don't see when you study chemicals separately. So from our perspective, it makes sense from a precautionary point of view to reduce or minimize the extent of wastewater contamination of drinking water.
Can you just do something as simple as kind of add up the amounts of all the different chemicals you might find in one water sample? And if so, would you then start to be getting closer to the levels of perhaps what we tend to regulate in drinking water?
You know, it might be possible to group certain chemicals that have the same biological pathway, but different chemicals have different potency. So it would be hard to just add them up in that way.
So, I mean, when we have these very different chemicals, as you said, acting through completely different pathways, this must be a very difficult problem to get a handle on in terms of what the health impacts or ecological impacts of these chemicals' presence would be.
There's certainly more that's known about ecological effects. There have been a number of studies throughout the country showing that fish populations that are downstream of a wastewater treatment plant can be impacted by the hormone disruptors or endocrine disrupting chemicals in that wastewater. And there have been examples of male fish that are feminized, and that has repercussions for the ability of a population to reproduce. There was a famous study in Canada in an experimental lake where they added just a few parts per trillion of an active ingredient in a birth control pill, and within a few years, it made the fathead minnow population in that lake crash. So there's kind of more that's known about the ecological effects, and you can imagine that it's easier to study fish or other organisms. You can bring them to the laboratory and study them throughout their whole lifetimes, and it's much harder to get that information for human health effects.
For both ethical and logistical reasons.
Absolutely.
So is there any evidence that chemicals at the parts per trillion level, at this just minuscule amounts, any evidence of a human health impact from any of these kinds of chemicals that we're finding in our drinking water?
So for the most part, these chemicals are not regulated in drinking water. So we don't have a drinking water standard that we can easily compare our results to. There have been several health-based guidelines that have been developed. So they're not enforced in the same way as a drinking water standard, but they're developed in the same way. And for one of our wells and one of the tap water samples we tested, the levels that we found of two of the perfluorinated chemicals, again, these are from nonstick and stain-resistant products, as well as having commercial applications, the highest level that we found was about one-half of the lowest guideline that's available. And guideline values are developed to be have safety factors, but the fact that some of the concentrations were getting close to that level does seem to merit further study.
So, but we're still at the level where you could presumably just say all of these are in such small levels that we don't really need to worry about it.
You know, we don't have any proof that they could cause an effect, but we also don't really have any studies that could have shown an effect. So so at this point, we really don't know, and I guess we take a precautionary approach when possible.
So how does this new study with looking at the public drinking water wells on Cape Cod advance our understanding of the general problem of contaminants of emerging concern and where they are showing up around Cape Cod?
Well, it's one of the first studies to look at the impact of septic systems on drinking water quality, but it's certainly not the only place in the country where people have septic systems or rely on groundwater. About a quarter of U.S. residents have a septic system, and about 40% of people rely on groundwater as a source of drinking water. So it gives us a better handle on the typical levels and the types of chemicals that show up. But we only tested for 100 emerging contaminants or so, and there could be many other chemicals that we didn't test for.
How did you choose those 100 to test for?
A combination of chemicals that we've previously found in our studies on Cape Cod. We've looked at groundwater and ponds on the Cape. We are particularly interested in endocrine-disrupting chemicals or hormone disruptors, especially those that mimic estrogen. Our mission has to do with understanding environmental causes of breast cancer, and one of our questions is whether there are hormone disruptors in the drinking water that might be related to that. So we wanted to include some hormone disruptors. And then we looked at other studies of groundwater and surface waters in other parts of the U.S. to identify chemicals that we might be likely to find.
So these are really some of the ones you would suspect and expect to be finding.
Certainly the ones that we found, most of them have been found in other locations. For two of the pharmaceuticals that we found, the highest level that we found was the same as the highest level that's been found in other parts of the U.S.
Talk a little bit about the technology that you actually use to detect these very low levels of chemicals.
So we don't have a lab at Silent Spring Institute, so we rely on partnerships with academic labs or commercial laboratories. So in this case, we worked with Underwriters Laboratory in Indiana, and they're one of the few commercial labs that are set up to do these kinds of trace level analyses. They basically extract all the organic chemicals in a water sample onto a cartridge, and then they put that into called a liquid chromatograph with mass spectrometry detection.
So, I mean, we were talking about the fact that, you know, first of all, we're looking at trace levels, very, very minuscule quantities in the water, and that many of these chemicals are in use all around us every day. Is there any concern about contamination of your water samples, that maybe these chemicals could be falling into your water samples from just the lab around you?
Well, we certainly took a lot of precautions to prevent that. We did blank analyses, so we took a bottle of pristine water from the lab out to the field with us and treated it like a real sample and made sure that when the lab analyzed those samples that we didn't see any of these chemicals showing up. We tested for caffeine as one of the chemicals we looked for, and so we personally avoided drinking any coffee or having any caffeine around us when we were taking these water samples. So we took precautions to make sure that these weren't just a result of contamination. And the laboratory also does blanks as well, where they internally run samples that are just lab water, and they make sure that these chemicals aren't showing up. So we're quite confident that these are really in the groundwater.
No caffeine while you do your research. That is dedication to science. How do you actually get the blanks, though? I mean, you're saying tap water has these chemicals in it. That's what you're actually testing for. How do you get blanks that you're sure are clean?
So the laboratory actually sends us their laboratory-grade water, and out when they send all the bottles for our sampling, and then we bring the bottles to the well where we do our water collection, and instead of collecting water from a spigot, we pour water from that bottle from the lab into our sample bottle. In every other way, it's treated as a real sample, and we don't tell the lab which ones are the blanks, so they can't be biased and figure out which ones are blanks.
In case you're just tuning in, my guest is Dr. Laurel Shader of Silent Spring Institute. We're talking this hour about research showing that Cape Cod's drinking water supply contains small quantities of pharmaceuticals, personal care products, and other household chemicals. Silent Spring Institute has also released recently another report, which is not really a new study in the sense of going out and getting new samples and conducting new analyses. It's a review, a synthesis of all the research on the topic. What is the value of doing such a review?
Well, unlike wastewater treatment plants, which have been studied extensively for their ability to remove emerging contaminants, there really have only been less than 20 studies that have measured levels of emerging contaminants that are discharged from septic systems. And there hasn't really been much effort to put all that together and come up with a typical concentration for the level that's discharged from a septic system. So we wanted to do that, so we compiled all the studies that we could find, and we identified about 10 emerging contaminants that have been best studied, I guess, and quantified or gave an estimate for the typical levels that are discharged into groundwater. And we wanted to do that because on the Cape we know 85% of residents have a septic system and the other 15 rely on a wastewater treatment plant, all of which also discharge into groundwater. And we wanted to get a sense of how much emerging contaminants were getting into Cape groundwater and where were those inputs most concentrated.
So could you list off for us those 10 chemicals that you found that were best studied?
Well, we studied a range that were of some that we thought would be well removed by septic systems. So acetaminophen, which is found in Tylenol, and caffeine were some of the ones that we found were well removed. And then there were others that were poorly or moderately removed. Sulfamethoxazole, which is an antibiotic, TCEP, which is a flame retardant, carbamazepine, which is an anti-epilepsy medication. And then there were some kind of more in the middle, such as nonylphenol. That's a detergent breakdown product.
So how would these chemicals be removed in the process of going through a septic system or going through a sewage treatment plant, and why do we see these differences between different chemicals?
So wastewater treatment plants and septic systems are not designed to remove emerging contaminants. They're designed to remove pathogens, to separate out solids, in some cases to address nutrients. But they're not specifically designed for emerging contaminants. Now, some chemicals, just because of their chemical structure, will break down as they pass through treatment. The bacteria and other microorganisms found in those systems can break those chemicals down. Others don't like to be in water. They like to stick to solids or stick to sludge, and so we expect them to be removed in a wastewater treatment plant by ending up in the sludge rather than in the water that's discharged. Now, a septic system has two main components. So you have a tank that mostly is designed to separate out solids by letting them settle out in grease and fats by having them float. But really where the removal is likely to occur is in the soil absorption system or leach field. So you've got pipes that kind of trickle out the effluent from the septic tank through some well-draining soil. And a couple things can happen there. You can have a very active microbial community, so bacteria and other microorganisms can break down those chemicals. You've also got soil surfaces that the chemicals can stick to.
Now, you were talking about the role of the bacteria in the septic systems, and I know in some cases, you know, if the septic systems of apartment buildings or homes for a large number of people, if there's kind of an infection that goes through and a large number of people end up on antibiotics, that can actually impact the effectiveness of the septic system by killing some of those microbes. Has anyone ever looked at whether any of these other chemicals actually impact the microbes that lived in the septic system?
That's a great question. I don't know if that question has been directly addressed, but you know, if you have a septic system, you're often advised not to flush down harsh chemicals, in part because they could affect the microorganisms that are helping with the treatment.
Yeah, we of course on the Cape always get the recommendation not to flush leftover medications to make sure that those are crushed up and separated from their bottle and put into the trash and dealt with in different ways to make sure that those aren't going down into our septic systems and presumably out into the groundwater and the rest of the ecosystem.
Yeah, and that's certainly great advice. I think it is important to keep in mind that for the most part, most of the pharmaceuticals that get into wastewater get there through excretion. So when you take a medication, your body does not absorb all of that medication, and so it ends up being excreted. So certainly not flushing medications makes a lot of sense. but we need to do more than that if we're concerned about pharmaceuticals getting into groundwater.
So you just kind of went through the ways that with typical septic system or sewage treatment technologies that are in use. In your study, you had a really nice graphic where you kind of lay out there are three ways that these chemicals could be removed from sewage. As you just kind of explained, they could stick to solids and be kept there. They could actually break down. But are there other technologies that could be deployed that might do a better job of removing or breaking down many of these emerging contaminants?
Certainly, with advanced treatment, you would expect some additional removal or at least transformation of some of these chemicals. So wastewater treatment plants add extra steps such as disinfection, nutrient removal, sometimes some kind of membrane filtration, and all of these steps have the potential to also remove emerging contaminants. There's been some study of alternative and innovative designs of septic systems, and some of those can also achieve greater removal. And there's been work done at the Massachusetts Alternative Septic System Test Center in Sandwich, where some of these alternative septic systems have been studied.
So, you know, as the Cape, towns all over the Cape are looking at trying to, in some way, handle wastewater issues. Are you aware, is this part of the conversation? Are emerging contaminants part of what's being considered as we look toward what we might do to better handle our wastewater?
For the most part, the focus right now is on nutrients. We know that nutrients, primarily from septic systems, but from other sources as well, are getting into coastal waters, into ponds. They're causing algae to grow too much and causing loss of quality habitat. And so the emphasis has really been on controlling nutrients, either by reducing the levels coming from septic systems, say by introducing more sewering, or by taking steps within that water body try to reduce the nutrient levels. We want to add a dimension to that discussion of emerging contaminants and make sure that people are also thinking about drinking water quality as well. It would be a shame to make a large investment in new infrastructure to deal with nutrients only to find out down the road that, you know, we're not meeting new drinking water standards that might be developed.
So do we have the information that we would need to begin in any way regulating these chemicals? I mean, I know, you know, Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection has a working group on emerging contaminants, as does the New England Interstate Water Pollution Control Commission and the EPA at the federal level. Obviously, this is something on people's minds, but does anybody feel like we're at the point where we could begin to regulate these chemicals, and should we?
Well, these chemicals are definitely on EPA's radar screen. There's a list called the Candidate Contaminant List that EPA puts together of chemicals that it's considering for future regulation. And some of the perfluorinated chemicals, again, these are with the non-stick and stain-resistant products, and some hormones are on the most recent candidate contaminant list. EPA also puts together a list of chemicals that it asks public water suppliers to test for in order to provide more information about typical levels and prevalence of chemicals in our nation's drinking water supply. Again, some of these perfluorinated chemicals and hormones are on that list as well. So EPA seems like they're at the point of still gathering more information, understanding potential health effects, and looking at kind of what's out there. It can be expensive to implement a new drinking water standard, especially for small water suppliers if their water is out of compliance. So EPA seems to take a cautious approach and make sure that any new standards will provide a health benefit that justifies the additional expense of potential new treatment.
Well, and of course, any sort of regulation would entail monitoring for these. Do any water suppliers currently monitor any of these contaminants of emerging concern, and would that even be feasible?
There are certainly water suppliers that are taking a proactive approach, and they do some testing of their own water. At this point, they're not really required to. In the case of our study on the Cape, we were really grateful that 9 water supply districts decided to take part in our study, and they all expressed an interest in, you know, wanting to know more about what's in their water and understanding what steps they can take now to better protect their water quality, because they see that in the future these chemicals might be regulated.
So, I mean, but let's talk about the feasibility here. We're talking about potentially hundreds of different chemicals that are in this big amorphous blob of contaminants of emerging concern. What is it actually feasible in terms of the number of chemicals that we could actually regulate and try to monitor in our drinking water?
That's a great question. You know, we right now regulate around 100 chemicals in drinking water, and it's been many years since a new chemical has been added. There are thousands of chemicals that are being used, and in many cases we have limited information about their potential health effects. The burden of proof in terms of causing potential harm is after the fact, that once chemicals have been used, and there is some push for more upfront testing of chemicals to ensure their safety before they go into use.
In terms of studying these chemicals, Silent Spring Institute has, over the years, really quite methodically and thoroughly tested every step along the way, looking at septic systems, groundwater just outside of septic systems, ponds, other groundwater, private drinking wells, public drinking wells, drinking water coming out of our taps, every possible step along the way on Cape Cod. Does that methodical and very thorough view of the situation add anything in the regulatory scenario in terms of what we know and where they're coming from and how they might be regulated?
It certainly provides new information about not just on Cape Cod, but other locations where you have septic systems and people relying on groundwater, and it adds to the growing body of knowledge of what's out there in terms of typical levels. We also found that wells with higher levels of nitrate and boron tended to have higher levels of emerging contaminants and more frequent detections. We also did some land use analysis where we looked at the extent of unsewered development, both residential and commercial development, in well recharge areas. So these are the areas that provide water to a well. And we also found, not surprisingly, that if you've got more development, more septic systems, you tend to see higher levels of these contaminants. So we hope that our results don't just provide more occurrence data, but also maybe some ways to predict other wells that might be impacted.
Well, and of course, all of these things that you're saying are intuitive. If they're coming from the septic system, then places where there's more development or more nitrates, which are associated with septic systems, you would see more of these pharmaceuticals. But actually putting hard scientific numbers to that, not just assuming or presuming that that would be the case.
That's right.
Now, in terms of the bigger picture that all of this research has put together, how applicable is this to other parts of the nation? I mean, we tend to think about Cape Cod as being a fairly unique situation, both in terms of being a sole source drinking water aquifer, also having such a heavy reliance on septic systems, and then also just the geology of Cape Cod being this glacial moraine, what was left behind by the glaciers when they retreated. How applicable is this kind of unique scenario to the rest of the country?
Yeah, that's a great question. There have been other studies. For instance, I saw a study in Nebraska where the soils were sandy and they were looking at private wells that were being impacted by septic systems. So it's not the only place where this happens. It is somewhat a unique combination of factors. I mean, many places have wastewater treatment plants. Many people rely on surface water bodies. But it's certainly not the only place where this kind of combination of factors can occur.
All right. Kalita is giving us a call from Mashpee. Kalita, what's on your mind?
Hi. I want to know how people are ingesting and taking in some of these chemicals, because I had heard that it's not just in drinking water, but you can also absorb these by just taking a shower. And I want to know if somebody could speak to that, of how we're getting these chemicals in our body. Thank you.
Well, certainly when you take a shower, there are small water droplets that you can breathe in, and so inhalation can be another exposure pathway. For some of these chemicals, it's important to keep in mind that there are other exposure pathways as well. If you have non-stick or stain-resistant products in your house, those chemicals can end up in the dust in your homes. I've got two little kids at home, so I think a lot about what ends up in the dust and on their hands and in their mouths. Some other Silent Spring Institute studies have looked at household exposures to chemicals such as flame retardants through dust and through indoor air. And it's something that we're trying to get a better handle on. There haven't been a lot of studies to really understand how much is coming through direct use of these products and comparing that to how much is coming from drinking water.
Great question, Kalita. Thank you so much for your call. If you have questions or comments, our phone number is 866-999-4626. You can also email us at livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. I'm talking this hour with Dr. Laurel Shader of Silent Spring Institute about contaminants of emerging concern, pharmaceuticals, personal care products, cleaners, the various chemicals in use in our homes every day, which can make their way into our drinking water supply by way of our septic systems. We're talking about how they do that and how concerned we should be for our health. You mentioned earlier that part of the goal, the mission of Silent Spring Institute is, of course, to study the possible causes of breast cancer and the elevated rates of breast cancer on Cape Cod. Is there any correlation between contaminated drinking water wells and breast cancer occurrence?
So we conducted an extensive study of breast cancer in the environment on Cape Cod. We were grateful for 2,000 women who took part in our study. Some of them have had breast cancer, some of them did not, and we did an extensive questionnaire to understand many life history considerations, where they had lived, what their occupations had been, and we tried to tease out whether there were any factors about Cape Cod that might help us explain why Cape Cod has higher breast cancer incidence. Right now, Barnstable County's rate is about 20% above the national average. We did find that the longer that a woman had lived on the Cape, it seemed that her risk of breast cancer increased. And this was after taking into account factors such as age, mammography use, in-migration, and known risk factors. As part of that analysis, we tried to recreate nitrate levels in a woman's drinking water throughout her lifetime, nitrate being a marker of wastewater, so potentially hormone disruptors or other chemicals in drinking water. That analysis did not show an association. However, there were many limitations. When women had lived off the Cape or if they had a private well, we didn't have a lot of specific information about their water quality. And even within a public drinking water system, there can be a lot of variation depending on your proximity to different wells within that system. It's also very difficult for a disease such as breast cancer to understand a link between a possible exposure and the disease, because we think that sensitive windows of time occur during puberty and even in the womb. So it's really hard to look back in time and understand what someone was exposed to. There was a separate study by researchers at Boston University that did suggest that there was an association between exposure to wastewater chemicals and breast cancer risk in one part of the Cape.
So certainly an open question. We've got some folks who want to get in on the conversation. Let's go to Debbie from Falmouth. Are you there, Debbie?
Hi, yes.
Go ahead.
You mentioned using clean lab water in your contaminant study. And I'm wondering, does using a home steam water distiller help to take out some of those chemicals?
That's a great question, Debbie. Are there things that we can be doing in our own homes to reduce our exposures?
Oh, that's a great question, Debbie. Thanks for bringing that up. We do think that home water filtration can reduce the levels of emerging contaminants. Water filters undergo third-party certification for regulated drinking water chemicals, but they don't undergo that same testing for these emerging contaminants. However, we think that solid carbon block filters, which have activated carbon in them, that's the same thing that's found in filter pitchers, do a good job of reducing the levels of these emerging contaminants. There are other ways to treat water, such as reverse osmosis, that could also get these chemicals out, although they're more costly and use more water. We definitely recommend that people understand and look into where their water is coming from. So if you're on a public water supply, you know, understand where those wells are located and look at the nitrate levels to see if they're elevated above background levels. So if the nitrate level is above 0.5 or 1 milligram per liter, that's showing a clear impact from a human source. If you have a private well, it's a good idea to get it tested regularly as well.
Now, so am I understanding you correctly? I mean, we've heard a lot in recent years about how, you know, maybe just the Brita pitcher in your fridge may not filter out metals or may not filter out, you know, certain things of concern. Are you saying that in fact, for some of these contaminants of emerging concern, these pharmaceuticals and personal care products, that may be enough?
Certainly, a filter pitcher or a solid carbon black filter, you know, where you have a separate little tap next to your faucet, can reduce, I don't know about all of these chemicals, but certainly some of these chemicals effectively. It's important to use them as suggested. So, for instance, filter pitchers should be used at room temperature to allow the water to filter through, and to change the filters as suggested, because the filters can actually become loaded up with chemicals, and if you leave them on too long, then those chemicals can start leaching out into the water. So definitely follow the guidelines.
I'm talking with Dr. Laurel Shader of Silent Spring Institute. If you have questions or comments, our phone number is 866-999-4626. Joel is giving us a call from Brewster. Joel, what's on your mind?
Hi, what a great program. Good questions and interesting replies.
Well, thank you. Do you have a question for us?
Regarding Heather's question about methodology, I think I heard the word spectrometry in there. Those must be amazing instruments. But my question is, do you know of any printed or online comparison of these septic systems that we have today and composting? I think these septic systems is a practice in inanity, and when you consider that most of the 10,000 lawns, tens of thousands of lawns in Cape Cod are drainage fields of septic systems, several feet underground, that much closer to the groundwater, and completely away from any benefits from UV frequencies or others. Nature's way is composting.
Okay, so Joel, thanks for the question. If you have questions, of course, our phone number is 866-999-4626. Laurel Shader, do we know anything about the effectiveness of composting? I guess maybe composting toilets would be the question here in terms of removing these contaminants of emerging concern.
Yeah, that's a great question from Joel and a nice segue to a new study that Silent Spring Institute will be conducting. Right now on the Cape, many communities are trying to figure out whether they should replace septic systems with sewer lines and have more wastewater, centralized wastewater treatment. But there's also a lot of interest in alternative approaches. So if you think about the waste that comes from our bodies, that actually contains most of the pathogens and about 80 to 85% of the nitrogen in our wastewater. So what we currently do is we flush that with really pristine drinking water, and then we mix that together with all the wastewater from our washing machines, our sinks, and our showers. And the levels are still high enough to cause a problem, but now we've increased the volume tremendously of the water that we have to deal with. So the idea of composting toilets or urine-diverting toilets is, let's divert that waste from the rest of our wastewater, keep the pathogens out of there, keep the nutrients out of there, and treat it separately on site. And, we're not talking about toilets that you would see at a campground. These look very much like conventional toilets. They don't smell. They look very nice. Some of them have foam flushing. So we have funding from Massachusetts Environmental Trust and from private donations to conduct a study of what happens to emerging contaminants in wastewater after you install an eco-toilet. And the town of Falmouth has actually set aside $500,000 to subsidize around 60 homeowners to install a composting toilet or urine-diverting toilet in their home. And they want to kind of verify that, yes, the nutrient levels can be reduced by, say, 80%, and that information can be used in making plans for reducing nutrients to impacted coastal waters or freshwater ponds. And so we're kind of piggybacking along with that. We would expect that chemicals we excrete from our bodies, such as pharmaceuticals or hormones, would be diverted by these composting toilets. But thinking more holistically, there are chemicals that might still be getting into groundwater, such as consumer product chemicals. And so we're very excited for this new project.
So that sounds like perhaps Joel needs to come back and ask that question in a few more years, and maybe
we'll have some answers in a year or two.
Okay. Bob is giving us a call from Falmouth. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi. I have an issue with water coming into my house. We had a problem with those white particles that came into the house, covered laundry and all that stuff. It's now dissipated. We've had the water test, and we still don't know what the white stuff is. But my question is, we're thinking of putting a whole house filtering system in to keep that stuff out and certainly clean the water. Would you recommend whole house filters?
Laurel Shader, any recommendations on filtration systems for homeowners?
That's a great question. You know, before investing in a new water treatment system, it's really important to understand exactly what's in your water. So I understand that the problem has dissipated for Bob right now, but it would be important to get a handle on exactly what was causing the problem and to think about, you know, if it's affecting your showers and your laundry, then you know, it's something that you might want to do for your whole home. If it's just something that you're worried about in drinking water, then you might not need to treat all that volume of water. So, you know, the county lab does offer testing for a range of water quality parameters. So I think it's important to understand exactly what's causing the problem, identify and avoid
it. It seems to be okay. But they can't determine what the white stuff is. And if that was dissipated, it's not coming in any longer. So I just tried. I didn't know what to do about the water coming in. I guess your answer is, what do I do? Find out what the white stuff is first and then do the filtration.
Yeah, I would say so.
All right, Bob.
All right, thank you very much.
Thanks
for your call, Bob. If you have questions or concerns you'd like to air, it's 866-999-4626 is our number, or you can email us at livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Laurel Shader, I wonder if there are resources where people could go to learn more about the different types of filtration that are available. Do you know of any great resources where people could, because they are so different, you know, they do take out different things and it's kind of complex to get your head around.
Sure. Well, the National Sanitation Foundation, or NSF, provides third-party testing for a range of water filters, and they post their results on the web. So that's one great resource. I also saw some fact sheets from the UMass Extension School that kind of walk through all the different kinds of water treatment. So I would recommend listeners take a look there.
All right. We got a comment from Mary Lou in Chatham, and she says she, in Connecticut, that she lived downstream from a Superfund site. Those, of course, are these sites of contamination that have been designated by the EPA as needing cleanup. She says, every step we can take is so extremely important because of chemicals we find in the water. I have a filter system on my home here in Chatham. When I hear about water pollution, I don't take any chances. Laurel Shader, I wonder how you respond to people who are very concerned about these. Do you try to reassure them that these are very low levels? Do you encourage them to be concerned and to take some steps?
I'd say some of both. You know, we definitely want to put our results into a context and explain what a part per trillion is, what's a nanogram per liter, and make sure that people kind of get a sense of how that fits into other potential exposure pathways. But we also think it's a great idea for people to learn more about where their water is coming from, and if they're concerned about chemicals, that, you know, filtering water as a precautionary step could be a good idea. The President's Cancer Panel several years ago did a study or released recommendations for avoiding environmental causes of cancer, and one of their recommendations was actually filtering water. This is due to concerns about disinfection byproducts. So these are chemicals that are formed in drinking water when water suppliers add chlorine or another disinfectant. So, you know, there certainly doesn't hurt to put a water filter on if these things are of concern.
I wonder, personally, do you have a water filter in your home?
I don't, but I certainly have been thinking about it. And we have one here at our Silent Spring Institute office, and I know many of our staff members do.
Now, cancer is something that's come up, you've mentioned a couple of times, as one of the possible concerns with some of these water contaminants. What are the kind of list of potential health impacts that we might be concerned about other than cancer?
Sure. So for some of the chemicals that we've found in drinking water, we know that much higher levels of exposure can be associated with harmful health effects. There can be effects on thyroid or liver. Some others are carcinogens, meaning they can cause cancer, or neurotoxins, so affecting the neurological system. So the effects can range quite widely. In the case of antibiotics, their presence in the environment certainly raises concerns about the potential for more antibiotic resistance bacteria.
Are any of these health impacts things that people might be feeling acutely that they might suspect have some relation to their water, or all of these more more chronic and perhaps milder symptoms?
Again, those types of effects have been associated with much higher levels of exposure, and we really don't know at these trace quantities what the effects might be.
All right. Well, I know that you and a couple of your colleagues will be at Barnstable Town Hall, I believe, next week, giving a public research update. Can you give us a preview of what you'll be talking about a little bit?
Sure. So every year we come down to the Cape to update the Cape community about our most recent research findings. Our next update will be next Wednesday at noon at Barnstable Town Hall in Hyannis. And I'll be presenting some highlights of our new study of septic systems and emerging contaminants and some previews of our new study on eco-toilets. We're also really pleased to have presentations by Anne McGuire. She's the co-founder and past president of the Massachusetts Breast Cancer Coalition. That's our sister organization and the organization that founded us almost 20 years ago. And she's one of the co-founders of Silent Spring Institute. We're also really pleased to have Dr. Jack Urban. He's an internationally recognized expert in breast cancer treatment, and he's the clinical director of the Tufts Medical Center Cancer Center. This event is free and open to the public, and lunch will be served.
All right. If you're interested in learning more about Silent Spring Institute's research on contaminants of emerging concern, you can attend that public research update. You can find links to details about that event, as well as the two reports we've been talking about today, on our website, capeandislands.org. You'll find Living Lab in the program menu. Dr. Laurel Shader is research scientist at Silent Spring Institute. Thank you, Laurel, for your time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me, Heather.
Until next week, this is Living Lab on the Point. Stay in touch with Living Lab Radio all week on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.